From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. It's such an honor to have you listening to us. We're so excited today. We're going to be talking about the Battle of Gettysburg. 150 years ago, this last week, almost 200,000
troops. You were in high school then.
I think I was, yes, probably pretty close to it. descended upon this little tiny town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and changed history forever. So we're going to be talking about that and the results of that battle and what went on during that time period. And it's going to be really exciting, I think. We've got three wonderful guests. Wonderful, a great guest, I would say, that are going to be talking about that. They're all Civil War experts in their own right. And so we're going to be talking about that. If you've got questions that you want to ask our experts, you can give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. Joining me in the studio this morning is my partner and co-founder of Veterans Radio, Airborne all the way, 101st Airborne, and one of the member of the Big Red One. If you're going to be one, you want to be a Big Red One. Bob Gould.
Hello out there.
Didn't you ever hear that before?
Well, you know, I can't wait for today's feature. I must say I don't have enough information on Gettysburg. There's so much out there, and I'm looking forward to getting a lot of answers.
It's fascinating. We were talking earlier. I mentioned that my dad took me to Gettysburg when I was about 10 years old, and you know, we walked all around the battlefield and all the monuments. It didn't mean that much to me. I just knew that it was something special, and it turns out that my great-great-grandfather was in the Confederate Army. He was not at Gettysburg. He went home early.
Was this Silas Thronberry?
No, this is David Rittenhouse Thronberry. And but anyway, he was in a battle down in Tennessee and got captured and didn't have shoes and all these other things and decided, all right, fine, I'm going home. Another great-great-grandfather was on the Union side, but he was down south with Sherman. But anyway, so it was fascinating. When I went back to Gettysburg with my own son about 20 years ago, much more interesting. And to stand up on these heights of Little Round Top or Big Round Top or Cemetery Ridge or all these different things that we've all heard about in history classes, just amazing how these people could just stand up and walk across these fields.
And we were talking about that this morning.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that later on about the tactics of Gettysburg and how so many people were killed and wounded, in such a short time period. Anyway, we'll talk about that. But we do have a big event. We have a big event coming up in the local Ann Arbor Ypsilanti area in August. And Bob, tell us all about it.
Okay, August 10th to 11th, the annual Thunder Over Michigan. Thunder Over Michigan at the Yankee Air Museum. By the way, get yourself a pencil pen because you're going to want to YankeeAirMuseum.org, YankeeAirMuseum.org, right? Everything is there. They're going to have static displays of aircraft, and they're going to also have flying. Now, you know, the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds have all been grounded because of sequestrian issues, but the Yankee Air Museum really, really, really went out for this particular Thunder Over Michigan. They're going to have an F-100 AB or an A-1 Skyhawk. Remember those in Vietnam? They went all the way. They were in service up to 1980. They're going to have an ME-262. That's a German. That was the first real official jet, fighter jet. Up close and personal, you'll see the thing fly. You'll also be able to have your picture taken next to it. There's going to be a gathering of Sky Raiders and UH-1H.
Hueys.
Yeah, we got those Hueys. Is that going to make you salivate a little bit?
It is already making me salivate because my understanding is that they're going to do a simulated
reenactment,
and I'm hoping for a ride.
During the reenactment.
Of course. I'll be one of the guys that jumps out for the first time.
Are you working on that right now?
I'm working on it.
Okay. And there's also going to be a World War II battle reenactment. So, folks, you want to get out there to the Yankee Air Museum. That's YankeeAirMuseum.org, YankeeAirMuseum.org, August 10th and the 11th. plenty of places to stay, motels, camping, et cetera, et cetera. And you can get your tickets in advance right now when you go to YankeeAirMuseum.org. So you're going to want to do that August 10th through 11th. It is kid-friendly.
It's very kid-friendly, old people-friendly, everybody-friendly.
Female-friendly, too.
Even female-friendly, yes, it's female-friendly.
Why do I want to go to an airport? Well, let me tell you why, because while Dad's having a good time, there's plenty of restrooms, lots of food.
Why would they be concerned about that? They want to see the aircraft, too. Today's generation want to fly those jets themselves.
You know what? I stand corrected on that. That's right.
Watch out. We're showing our age.
Well, okay, YankeeAirMuseum.org, August 10th and 11th. See you there.
Be there. We're going to be there, and it's going to be exciting. I can't wait to go that. Meanwhile, we're going to be taking a break in just a second. We're going to be coming back, talking with our guests, and talking about Gettysburg 150 years later. Who'd have thought that this battle would have such an important part of American history? And so we'll be right back after this.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Southerns, hear ye country call ye, I've blessed worse than death before ye. Two arms, two arms, two arms in Dixie. Though all the beacon fires are lighted, let all hearts be now united. Two arms, two arms, two arms in Dixie. Advance the flag of Dixie, hoorah, hoorah. For Dixie's land we take our stand and live or die for Dixie. Two arms, two arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. Two arms, two arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. Oh, hear the northern thunder, mutter.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and that's a little bit different version of Dixie that I had not really heard the words before.
Abraham Lincoln called that the most inspirational military song ever up to that time. Isn't that something? He did.
And well, you know, think of all the people that have used it as their battle cry in sports ever since then.
But
I think they changed the words on it, though.
When the war ended that night, Lincoln came out on the balcony, and there was a band, a Marine band below, and he had them play Dixie.
He did. He did. Well, we're back here on Veterans Radio. We're going to be talking about Gettysburg 150 years later, and our guests, we're going to start bringing them on the line here. First of all, is our good friend and Veterans Radio contributor, and that's Dwight John Zimmerman. And Dwight is an author, as we all know. He's president of the Military Writers Society of America. He's written about every war, I think, since the history of man, and is very knowledgeable on the Civil War. He's a co-author with Bill O'Reilly of Lincoln's Last Days. And later on in the program, he's going to be talking about his other books, some of his other books, but this one is Uncommon Valor, the Medal of Honor, because the Medal of Honor was introduced during the Civil War. Dwight, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Dale. I'm happy to be here. I'm talking to you from Forward Operating Base, Brooklyn.
That's right. Fire Support Base, Brooklyn.
And it's very hot here, too. We're going to be in the 90s.
That's what I understand. Then everybody can really relate to...
Move to Michigan, babe.
Yeah, we just sent all this humidity to you. Thank you very much. Hold on the line, Dwight. We'll be back with you in just a second. Also joining us on the line is Wayne Van Sant, who is the author and illustrator of the graphic history of Gettysburg, which was... we have talked with Wayne before. And Wayne, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Glad to be here.
It's cool. Your book is really neat. It's sort of a classics illustrated of Gettysburg, and I really encourage people to get a good idea of what happened at Gettysburg is to go out and get this book, the graphic history of Gettysburg.
Well, you know, there's no way of you know, we have a lot of photographs or a lot of paintings and stuff like that, but we can only speculate on what it was actually like in the battles, and that's what I'm kind of trying to do. You know, we don't know exactly what Pickett's charge looked like. We have a lot of good descriptions of it, but that's one thing I like to do these books for, because you can actually, you know, participate in the battle.
Yeah, in some of the research I was doing for today's program, I was looking at some of the artwork that the on-site illustrators, I guess would be a lack of a better word, could do, since, I mean, photography was invented, but you're not going to send Matthew Brady out in the middle of Pickett's charge and set up his camera and say, okay, guys, hold for a second so I can take this picture. But they had people drawing what was occurring, and then I forget the particular artist, but then he would go back sometimes and actually make a full-scale painting of what he had sketched during the battle.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
So you're just continuing that trend.
I would guess so. I've done a lot of different wars. I've worked with Dwight a number of times, and you have to go on what you what's available. Mm-hmm. The one great thing about the internet, I mean, Google Images, you can find a photograph of just about every officer mentioned in the battle.
That's very true. That's very true.
Very helpful.
Well, we're going to be talking a little bit more about that with Wayne and with Dwight, but right now I want to bring on the air our third guest for the program. I think I just lost him.
Yeah, push the first button. There you go. That guy. Yeah.
Oh, that first button. Sorry. Craig Simons.
Yeah.
Is it Simmons or Simons?
Simons.
All right. Craig Simons is a professor emeritus at the United States Naval Academy, where he taught naval and Civil War history for 30 years. He's one of America's most respected Civil War historians. He's written numerous critically acclaimed and award-winning books, including Gettysburg, A Battlefield Atlas, which I found really cool when I found it, and The American Heritage History of the Battle of Gettysburg and Lincoln and His Admirals, for which he won the prestigious Lincoln Prize. Craig, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much.
This has been
fun.
It should be fun. It should be fun. Craig, I'm going to come to you first, and I'm going to ask you to describe to our audience what was General Lee doing in Pennsylvania.
Well, Lee always believed that time was not a Confederate ally. I mean, he could count as well as anybody else. He knew the North had more men, more money, more resources, more railroad mileage, almost anything that you could count. The North had more of it. So that a long war would, he believed, eventually wear down the Confederacy's ability to fight that war and win it. So what he wanted to do was strike a dramatic blow at the North, a psychological blow almost as much as a military blow. He invaded, if that is in fact is the proper word, Maryland, intending to go further north during the Antietam campaign in 1862. That came unglued after the Battle of Antietam. But in the spring of 1863, after winning the Battle of Chancellorsville, he really thought this was his best chance to fight a major battle in the North, perhaps lay siege to a northern city, and in that way convince the northern electorate to withdraw its support of the Lincoln administration, bring the Lincoln administration to the negotiating table, and end this thing.
Well, so we got General Lee heading up into Pennsylvania. I know when I was reading the things that, you know, he was heading towards Harrisburg, which is the capital of Pennsylvania. And I guess he was going to do this flanking movement to come around and kind of get, you know, access to Washington and Baltimore and then say, okay, guys, let's end this thing.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. Remember that an army of 73,000 men, which is the figure most historians agree upon for the size of Lee's army in this campaign, cannot move on a single road.
Right.
I mean, that would make a column, you know, so long it would be useless. So, of course, his different army corps were moving on different roads, and I think Lee was flexible enough as a tactician and even as a strategist that if an opportunity to move toward Harrisburg or Baltimore or Washington presented itself, he could bring those various elements of his army together to execute that plan. But I think when he moved north into Pennsylvania, his idea was, let's see what works out here.
Well, let's talk a little bit, and Wayne and Dwight, if you want to jump in, feel free to do that. How did they choose Gettysburg, or did Gettysburg choose them?
Well, pretty much the latter of those two. Gettysburg, which is the county seat of Adams County, happens to be sit at the nexus of a road network. There are 10 roads that run into what they call the Diamond, the little town square right downtown. And if you go due north, you go up to Carlisle, and if you go south, you go down to Emmitsburg, and if you go east, you go to Baltimore, and if you go west, you go to Fairfield. And all these roads are named for those various destinations, and they all converge on Gettysburg. And when Lee realized that the Union Army was closer to him than he had thought, he realized he had to bring those various disparate elements of his army together. And looking at the map, it seemed to him that Cashtown or Gettysburg was the place where the road network would allow them all to come together quickly. And that's how Gettysburg became the center of it.
Okay, because I remember reading about one of his generals being heading up toward Carlisle and having a little battle up there, and some of these other guys had battles. And then you had, I guess I should back up a little bit and talk about the command structure of the Confederate Army. Stonewall Jackson had been killed at Chancellorsville, I believe, and so this provided Lee with probably an inopportune opportunity to restructure his whole army, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Previous to that, prior to Chancellorsville, he had divided his army into two wings, or what we might call corps today, and Jackson had commanded one of those. Jackson and Longstreet were his two, his right hand and his left hand. After Jackson was killed by friendly fire in the Battle of Chancellorsville early in May, obviously he needed to find someone to replace him. Well, you can't really replace a person like Stonewall Jackson, and the army was somewhat larger than it had been, so he decided this was an appropriate time to divide that army into three corps. And technically, a fellow named Ewell, James Brown Ewell, became Jackson's replacement, if you would, in command of that corps, but it was a somewhat smaller unit than it had been before. Longstreet remained in command of the first corps, but Lee then created another corps, the second corps, under Ambrose Powell Hill. Powell Hill, so he had three, if you would, a corps moving up on separate roads into the north, as well as his grand division of cavalry, which he called it, nearly 10,000 men, mounted, all under the command of Stuart, Jeb Stuart. And so really there are four fingers, if you would, of Confederate Army moving north into Pennsylvania on various and nearly parallel roads.
Okay. Dwight, tell me a little bit what you know about Jeb Stuart. He certainly had a little bit of a personality, didn't he?
Well, yes. Excuse me. He was certainly one of the most flamboyant of generals on either side. And, of course, he played to the audience, the dashing cavalryman. He was the beau ideal of that. And the problem was that Gettysburg turned out to be not his finest hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his separate, you know, he was supposed to, of course, be Lee's eyes and ears. And unfortunately, when he took off, he broadly interpreted Lee's orders. Lee had a tendency to give what would more be called suggestions than orders, or general guidance. The advantage being, of course, it allowed a general to seize advantage of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, two things worked against Stuart, and the crucial part was that the Union cavalry had improved, and it came as a rude shock to Stuart. The result was that as the rest of Lee's army is going north, Lee doesn't know where the Army of the Potomac is.
Right. Well, going back to that, and Wayne, maybe you can answer this question. There was a new commander of the Army of the Potomac put in place about 2 days before the Battle of Gettysburg. Isn't that true?
That's true. The commander had been, let's see, Hooker, and he was replaced by, oh my gosh, drawing
Meade.
A blank right now.
Mr.
Meade.
Yep.
And Meade was just sort of kind of in line and turned out to be pretty able. Nothing spectacular, but he did his job anyway. But you're talking about the communications of the armies. They just didn't have it like we have today, but that's primarily what the cavalry was for.
Mm-hmm. I understood that, Craig, I'm going to come back to you on this one, is that Stewart kind of took off on his own and, you know, did a fainting attack on Washington and kind of was meandering, seemed like hither and yon, east of where Lee was to find out what was happening. How did they communicate? Because it's baffling to me that they were able to get any messages to each other.
Yeah, Stewart's ride is very controversial. It was then, remains so now. A couple of things had happened. Stewart, first of all, had taken over as commander of Jackson's corps when Jackson was mortally wounded at Chancellorsville, and he kind of thought he might get that job permanently. So there was a bit of disappointment that he was relegated, if you would, to the rank, back to his command of the cavalry. The other thing is that just prior to leaving for Gettysburg, Stewart had fought a skirmish at Brandy Station against Union cavalry and had been caught napping. I mean, he was almost literally in his pajamas when the Union stormed into his camp, and though he rallied and managed to drive them off, it was kind of embarrassing. So one of the psychological factors here is that Stewart seemed to be bent on proving himself during this campaign. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing that comes into play here is that, as Dwight mentioned, Lee liked to give discretionary orders, you know, as if, well, if you see an opportunity here, do this. If you see an opportunity there, do that. And those kinds of discretionary orders came down to Stewart saying, if you see an opportunity to ride to the east of the army, you may do so, but, there's always a but here, ensure that you rejoin the head of the army in Pennsylvania as soon as possible. Well, Stewart saw that as an opportunity to perhaps fulfill this goal that he had of proving himself, and he left two of his brigades with the army. So they weren't entirely without cavalry, but he took the best three brigades and the best three brigade commanders with him on this ride eastward. And the problem is, as the Union army moved north and Stewart tried to get around them, he couldn't get all the way around them as fast as he thought he would be able to. And then, near Rockville, outside Washington, as you mentioned, he ran into a federal wagon train. And remember, the Confederates are always looking for opportunities for supplies and material. Well, here's this 140 wagons filled with new supplies, and he thought, boy, I'm going to take that. And he went charging after it, captured it, but then, of course, he had to bring it with him, which slowed him down again. So it wasn't that he was meandering. He was more or less following discretionary orders. But several things conspired to keep him away from the battlefield so that when the two armies came together at Gettysburg, Stewart wasn't there. And famously, Robert E. Lee said, I cannot imagine what has become of Stewart. And since Stewart's job was to bring Lee information, Lee had less information than he would like to have had going into that battle.
Can we back up just for a second, and I want to talk about the personalities of these officers on the north and on the south. And you just said that, you know, General Lee, who is, you know, famous throughout our history anyway, is this, you know, genius of moving armies back and forth and, you know, taking advantage of what the other people do. And many of the generals, as you said, because of his orders, were very, you know, not quite precise, versus the Union generals who seem to just plod along. Craig, can you talk about that just a little bit?
I think plodding is a little harsh. I think the really bad decision that the Union had in terms of their commanders was George McClellan. I think everybody agrees on that. George McClellan was a strutting little peacock who thought much more of himself than almost anybody else did, believed he was infallible, thought Lincoln was an idiot, called him the original gorilla, and so on. That whole experiment with McClellan in command that had taken place long before Gettysburg, that was a disaster. Hooker was not so great either. Hooker, like McClellan a little bit, very much impressed by himself. Meade was kind of a plodder, as Wayne suggested, but he was a diligent, hardworking, conscientious soldier who remained in command of the Army of the Potomac for the rest of the war. But you're right in this respect. The Confederacy got its best commander, Robert E. Lee, early in the war. When Joseph E. Johnson was wounded in the battles outside Richmond early in 1862, Lee took over, proved that he was a deft battlefield commander, tactician, strategist, leader. It took the North longer, and Lincoln has sometimes been criticized for this, this sort of revolving door of Union commanders in the East. But I think he ended up with probably the best guy in the end, and that's Ulysses S. Grant. Of course, that comes after Gettysburg. But at Gettysburg, you've got this fellow Meade, who up to this point has been a subordinate to these indifferent generals. But as a Pennsylvanian, one of the reasons Lincoln chose him is not only, as Wayne said, he was sort of next in line, but also he was from Pennsylvania. And Lincoln, who was prone to using these sort of, you know, country aphorism, said that he would fight well on his own dunghill, which is not exactly a compliment to Pennsylvania, but the idea was that he would defend his own turf, and apparently he did do that.
Well, it's kind of lucky, I guess, that they finally got somebody in there that could do that. Wayne, when you were drawing these pictures of these, I don't have your book in front of me, these pictures of these officers from either side, the Southern generals seemed so much more flamboyant. And maybe they were just getting better press at the time.
No doubt. They did have that flair. In fact, I think the whole army did. But it was just a different kind of army. I doubt if they ever stood inspection. I can't imagine the ragged Confederates being lined up to be nitpicked. But they were a different kind of independent army. And I think what was said earlier about giving individual orders to people, Lee was able to give orders to somebody like Jackson that could take independent action. And just many of the Union commanders that we know of weren't able at that point in time.
I'd like to step in with a little comment there as well, because there was a steep learning curve for all the senior commanders, because no one, Southern or North, ever had experience of command of such a large force. You know, even people as accomplished as Lee had to figure out how to handle such large bodies of men. In the case of the South, well, they had pretty much the best and the brightest, because so many of the West Point graduates were from the South. And loyalty to one state was more important than loyalty to the nation. As James McPherson and other historians have pointed out, prior to the Civil War, the United States was spoken as plural. After the Civil War, then the nation was the United States was referred to as singular. And getting back to what Craig said earlier about the clock ticking, with respect to the learning curve for the generals, Grant later made a very salient point about how eventually the Union generals were proving to be equal in many respects to the more famous Southern generals.
Well, it seems like that the vast majority of the generals on both sides were West Point grads. Is that correct, Dwayne?
Yes, actually, it was one of the more impressive things. And General Winfield Scott made a point, this is going back to the Mexican War, of praising the West Point graduates, because they became the nucleus of our army, which really was a very small force, essentially a garrison.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to jump in and say something. If you're going to give all this praise to West Point, as an Annapolis professor, I've got to say a few words here. And that is the enormous expansion. Remember the Army. Dwight makes a very good point. The Army is tiny before the war. The United States Army is about 16,000 men scattered in 70 or so little frontier posts, you know, those log things we used to watch on TV shows when we were kids. That's where the army is. They were a constabulary force against the Western Indians. So to turn that into this enormous 2.4 million man continental army meant enormous expansion. West Pointers who were first lieutenants and captains became colonels and generals almost overnight.
That's right.
So while they were trained in a military education and perfectly competent in the jobs that they had done, the jobs they're facing now, as Dwight points out, entirely different from the jobs they'd had before. And then the expansion into the number of regiments meant that mayors and congressmen and fire chiefs and police chiefs all put themselves forward as able to lead a regiment and became overnight colonels. So a lot of these guys commanding regiments are just right in off the street.
right. Sorry to interrupt you, but we need to take a break. We'll be right back. We're talking about the Battle of Gettysburg 150 years later. We're going to get into the battle after these messages. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. A father and his son were both awarded the Medal of Honor. Details after this.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
First Lieutenant Arthur MacArthur was awarded the Medal of Honor for seizing the colors of his regiment at a critical moment and planting them on the captured works on the crest of Missionary Ridge, Tennessee, November 25, 1863. His son, General Douglas MacArthur, was awarded the Medal of Honor for conspicuous leadership in preparing the Philippine Islands to resist conquest, for gallantry above and beyond the call of duty in action against invading Japanese forces, and for the heroic conduct of defensive and offensive operations on the Bataan Peninsula. His utter disregard of personal danger under heavy fire and aerial bombardment, his calm judgment in each crisis, inspired his troops, galvanized the spirit of resistance of the Filipino people, and confirmed the faith of the American people in their armed forces. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com.
On Veterans Radio, and I thank Bob for going out and getting that live recording during the Battle of Gettysburg. That was Battle Cry of Freedom.
You know, it makes me even want to join right now. I mean, really, all this marching music.
I mean, Sousa
around during that time?
Anybody? I don't think Sousa. I think Sousa was alive, but I don't think he was writing songs at the time. Anyway, we're talking about the Battle of Gettysburg 150 years later, and our guests are Greg Simons, Wayne Van Sant, and Dwight Zimmerman. And if you want to get in on ask these experts a question, give us a call at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. We spent the first part of the program talking about some of these personalities. Craig, I want to go to you. How did this whole thing start? How did this battle begin?
Well, the battle begins when Lee decides that after Chancellorsville, he's going to take his army north. We mentioned that he had tried it once before in 1862 and was turned back at Antietam. He saw an opportunity now. It's May. It's early in the campaign season. Remember, in the 19th century, armies really had to move only from the spring to the fall. They had to feed their livestock, the mules that pulled the wagons, the horses that they rode. They couldn't carry all that fodder with them, so campaigning in the winter was really impossible. The hay was the oil of a 19th century army, and so they had to have it to campaign. So here it is, May. It's early spring. The campaign reaches out before him. He can either leave the initiative to the north and wait for them to attack him again, or seize the initiative himself and he was the kind of guy who wanted to seize the initiative. So he decides to go north in May of 63, and that's the road that led him eventually to Gettysburg.
All right, so it's July 1st of 1863. What happens next?
Well, the 1st of July is this is a three-day battle for those of your listeners who don't know Gettysburg as well as some of the folks you have on your program here. It's a three-day battle, and it's the 1st, 2nd, 3rd of July. And on the 1st, the two armies bump into each other, almost literally. Nobody plans this confrontation. One finger of Lee's army is coming down what's called the Cashtown Road toward Gettysburg, kind of to see what's in front. Remember, they're moving without cavalry because Stuart is off east of them or up north at Carlisle. So the infantry is moving along the road, and they bump into a group of Union cavalry on a ridge just west of the town near a little farm owned by a fellow named McPherson, no relation to Jim. But McPherson's Ridge is the place where they first bump into each other early in the morning on the 1st of July.
Okay, so they start there, and then everybody starts congregating on Gettysburg. Is that
they begin piling in. You know, you feed in supplies from one, a reinforcement from one side, reinforcements come in from the other side. There's a very dramatic moment when the so-called Black Hat Brigade, the Iron Brigade from the 1st Corps, the Union, tough Union group from the Midwest, shows up on the field just at the critical moment and comes plowing into line. John Reynolds is killed, the commander of the 1st Corps, probably the best corps commander in the Union Army. He's killed almost in the first exchange of fire, so it devolves now onto Abner Doubles Bay, who takes over on McPherson's Ridge, and there's pretty close hand-to-hand fighting west of the town on the morning of July 1st.
So as we go through the day, what occurs? By the end of the first day, what is the setup now?
Well, the south wins the first day. I think my two fellow commentators wouldn't disagree with that. They're able to drive the Federals off that ridge. Then they envelop them by coming around and push them all the way through town back onto this little cemetery south of town on what, of course, becomes famous as Cemetery Hill. But the first day is a Confederate victory, without a doubt.
So the North ends up fighting a defensive battle, correct?
Yes.
Instead of on the offense, they're on the defense. And because Lee doesn't have his eyes and ears out there, he's not aware of how large the Union number of troops are. Is that correct?
That is true. And what he doesn't know is that it's only one corps at first, and then by the end of the day, two corps when the 11th Corps comes up. He's got most of his army together, but he doesn't know for sure. And so he gives one of those famous discretionary orders. He tells Jackson's replacement, Ewell, he says, you know, those folks up on that hill, if you think you can take them, you should do it. This is on the night, late afternoon of July 1st. Well, Ewell's new to command, too. He's only been in charge since Jackson was killed. He doesn't know how many men are up on that hill. He doesn't have any scouts out either to know what's in front of him and what's not. So he says, well, listen, can anybody from Hill's Corps help me out? And Lee says, no, it's up to you. If you can do it, go ahead. If you don't think so, then don't. Well, he decides not to. Now, that has been probably one of the most controversial aspects of this whole battle from the beginning. Southerners, ever since, have said, if Jackson had been there, he'd have done it. They'd have won the battle that first day. All of U.S. history would have changed. Maybe so. I don't know. I'd like to hear what Dwight and Wayne think of that.
Well, I approach it from this other viewpoint in that Lee and Longstreet were at loggerheads in how to prosecute this battle. Longstreet was all for the Confederates taking the defensive position and letting the Union Army attack them, and that set up, of course, what wound up being an even more famous controversy on the third day.
Yes, that's true.
There's all kinds of speculation on that Longstreet was so unhappy with the situation that he'd shrug his feet, and that if he had moved faster or whatever, it may have been different, but he did not like the ground at all. He saw the advantage that the Army of the Potomac had.
Yes. So let's go from the first day to the second day. So,
I want to just interject one thing real quickly. John Buford, who was in charge of the Army of Potomac's cavalry, okay, it was his unit that made the initial contact. But what has always puzzled me is, after that initial contact, the Union cavalry became a non-factor. And Craig, I'd like to get your view on why that happened.
Yeah, well, of course, the cavalry's job is essentially to get the information, report the information back, and then get out of the way while the infantry does the heavy lifting in a battle. And essentially that's what happened. The cavalry's job was to then move out to the flanks on both sides, both south of Gettysburg and out to the northeast of Gettysburg, and guard against any forces coming in. But their job really isn't to fight a battle. I know that when we envision a 19th century battle and we think of the cavalry, we think of cavalry charges with pennants flying and swords drawn and so forth. There actually was one of those at Gettysburg, but they're extremely rare. And the cavalry's primary job is to scout, to gather information, to harass the enemy lines of supply, and to guard the flanks. And so after Buford fell back to make way for Reynolds and subsequently Doubleday as they took over on McPherson's Ridge, he took his cavalry out to the flanks, most of them north and east of the town, where they fought a cavalry battle on the third day during Pickett's charge, and we can get to that when we talk about the third day. But you're right, it does seem odd. Buford was one of the more talented federal commanders, and yet once he does his job of identifying the enemy, deciding that this is good ground to fight on, and calling for the infantry to come up to his support, he kind of backs off and says, "Go get him, infantry."
So the first day ends with the South basically winning that part of the battle. On the next morning, on July 2nd, what happened? How come they didn't, you know, push their advantage?
Well, that's exactly what Lee wanted to do. When this, you know, both Dwight and Wayne mentioned this disagreement between Lee and Longstreet, and it's become famous over the years, and I suspect somewhat exaggerated, but at root, the idea is Longstreet says, effectively, we have them right where they wanted, they're back on their heels, let's maneuver around behind them, block them off from Washington and Baltimore, that will force them to attack us, and we will have the better tactical position. And Lee says, no, don't you understand? We have driven them. They are back on their heels. Their morale is down. Our morale is up. It's a meeting engagement. They're not entrenched. We'll never have an opportunity like this again in the war. And in terms of numbers and position and entrenchments, he's absolutely right. We've got to push this. So he gives Longstreet orders. I want you to attack them on their left flank, coming up from the south, up the Emmitsburg Road, attack them on their left flank. And here is where the controversy emerges, because Longstreet can say no more than, yes, sir, what else can he do? But it takes him until 4 o'clock in the afternoon to do it. And the question is, should it have taken that long? Could he have done it faster if his heart had been in it, or was he simply being the careful subordinate he had always been in getting all his ducks in a row before he launched that attack? So there's really very little fighting from the time the sun comes up on July 2nd until the middle of the afternoon, when Longstreet's force finally does execute that attack from the south, and that leads to the famous engagements in the Peach Orchard and the Wheatfield and Devil's Den.
And this is where some maximum damage was done to the both sides. This is when the casualties are at their highest?
Yes, this is the bloodiest day. The middle day is the bloodiest day. Pickett's charge gets most of the ink, but the middle day, July 2nd, is actually the bloodiest day of the fighting.
And we have to take a break, unfortunately. But we'll be right back after we take this break, and we're going to talk about the end of the second day, go into Pickett's charge. And, Dwight, I hadn't forgotten. I want you to talk a little bit about the Medal of Honor if we can get to that. We may have to do a part two of this program, I think. So you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after these messages.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding,
federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
On Veterans Radio. We'll have to cut that one a little bit short because I want to get back into this second day battle. So with the battle finally commences at 4 o'clock in the afternoon because of whatever reasons it takes everybody so long to move. But in the meantime, now we've got most of the federal troops are there, but they're on the other side of the hills there. Is that correct, Wayne?
The one advantage that they had, you know, Union line that's been described as a fish hook with the eye down at the round tops and the hook going back and bending over to the right over Culp's Hill. Well, one advantage they had for that was the Union forces could move to different parts of the battlefield pretty easily, where what they call the inside lines. And the Army of Northern Virginia had a much longer area, and that's one of the things that Longstreet complained about to make that attack up the Emmitsburg Road. He had to move his forces way down to the southwest, and so that was one advantage the Union forces had.
So the lines of the south were spread out much, much further apart, whereas the Union troops were all centered around, as you mentioned, that fishhook with the cemetery.
Yeah, I think they could get in about half an hour get to any point in the battlefield. I can't remember for sure. You guys probably know better than I do on that, but it was pretty close in that area.
Yeah, but then what happened was Sickles, the commander of Third Corps, made an unauthorized move that just about threatened to hand victory to the Confederacy. Craig did a wonderful job in his history of the Battle of Gettysburg to talk about that. So it took everyone by surprise. Craig, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I can. This is another one of those interesting personalities. Dan Sickles, a real character. In fact, his biography is entitled American Scoundrel, and not inappropriately. Sickles is one of those fellows we call a political general. He's not a West Point graduate. He's not a military person. He was a congressman who volunteered to raise a brigade, and because he raised it, he got to be the brigade commander, a brigadier, then was promoted to major general. Now he's in command of a corps, but he's not a professional soldier of any kind. But he is in command of the left-hand side. If you can imagine the Union facing west with the Confederates coming from that direction, the extreme left-hand end of that is Sickles' command. And as he looked out in front of him, he said, I don't like the looks of this. This doesn't look good at all. I'm going to go up there. And he tells Meade, I'm going to go. And Meade says, no, don't do it. I order you to stay where you are. And Sickles says, what does he know? And marched out there anyway. So he has put his command out in a salient, that is the point, out in front of the Union line. And that is exactly where Longstreet's attack strikes the Union when finally it gets underway at 4 o'clock. So here comes Longstreet charging through. And these are some of the best troops in the Army of Northern Virginia. This is Hood and McLaws, and these folks have been around. They know the score, and they come charging in, and they just absolutely overwhelm Sickles' command, drive it more than a mile all the way back onto Cemetery Ridge, inflicting heavy losses, suffering losses as well. And one of those wounded is Sickles himself, who is carted off the field with a a shell through his leg and smoking a cigar rather flamboyantly. But, yeah, Sickles very nearly undid all the careful preparations that Meade made to receive this charge. And it looks for a while like Longstreet's attack, even though it was delayed, is going to be successful, and it very nearly was.
So what happens the rest of that day? I know that this is where part of the second day, I think, is where Chamberlain from Maine is involved in this. So we've all seen that in the movie Gettysburg.
Right. Very famous small unit engagement on the very end of the line. Wayne mentioned the Round Tops on the extreme left of the Union line. Little Round Top is where Chamberlain's 20th Maine was defending its position. They took on two Alabama regiments, and in a classic small unit engagement, managed to hold their position, even though at one point they actually ran out of ammunition and had to conduct a bayonet charge. And elsewhere, all along that front line, there are other heroic moments. There was a famous attack by the 140th New York, led by Patty O'Rourke, who was killed on that hill that day. That counterattack probably saved the Union position. And a third one was when the 1st Minnesota conducted essentially a sacrificial attack against the advancing Confederate brigade that cost it all but 47 men of its 262 that went into that battle. Only 47 came out alive. So there are really dramatic small unit engagements where particular Union regiments plug holes in the collapsing Union line just at the right time to save that line. And when the sun set that night, the Union position remained intact. It had taken terrible losses. Longstreet very nearly broke through. But as the sun sets, the Union is still in position.
Bob?
Yeah. This is Bob Gould. I have a question. And this has to do with Chamberlain. There was a squad or a platoon or a battalion that was lost, and they were sent out to go further along south, along on Little Round Top, but somehow they lost track of each other. And right there, when Little Round Top was at the height of battle with Chamberlain, right at that moment, this lost, quote-unquote, battalion, platoon showed up and really made the difference. Can you just very quickly comment on that?
I can. Actually, they weren't lost. Chamberlain knew he was the very last regiment at the very end of a 2.5-mile-long line and thought, you know, if anybody gets around the corner here and comes up behind me, I'm toast. So he went to it was a company, actually Company B. Each regiment is made up of 10 companies. And he went to Company B, and he said, Lieutenant, I want you to take your company out there beyond our left flank and just kind of keep an eye out. If you see anybody coming around our left, you know, you make some noise, shoot a gun, come running in, whatever. Just make sure we don't get flanked here. So they had been put out there on purpose. They weren't lost. They weren't sure where they were, but Chamberlain knew where they were. And so when the 20th Maine was attacked, they actually turned inside of that position well out into the woods. And these guys heard all this noise and said, well, we better get in on this, and came charging in from behind the two Alabama regiments. So that helped, bring panic to the ranks of the Southern soldiers and probably helped decide the engagement. But, yeah, here's a case where probably 20 men total had an impact on that small unit action, which had an impact on the whole line all the way stretching for 2.5 miles to the north. So a very few number of people at the right place at exactly the right time can have an overwhelming impact on history.
It's fascinating when we're doing this. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, and so we're going to have to do a part two on this. So I want to make sure all three of you, hopefully I will get in touch with you in the next week or so and schedule to do the third day and really what did happen on that fateful Pickett's charge and so forth. So I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Dwight, I wanted you to just mention, if you can, in 2 minutes, the Medal of Honor was born during this era. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the Medal of Honor and some of those anecdotal stories? You got about 2 minutes.
In 2 minutes?
Yep, that's it.
Okay. Well, I will say that the Medal of Honor, yes, you're correct. It was created, authorized during the Civil War. The first one was the Navy Medal of Honor. The Army, there was an Army colonel who designed it, but this was when Winfield Scott was the general, and he thought that, you know, such things were smacked of British imperialism, so he didn't want it for the Army, but the Secretary of the Navy, so many of his Annapolis graduates had gone over to the Confederacy that he was looking for a way of helping boost morale for the ranks. And initially, the Medal of Honor was only awarded in the Navy, at least, to the ranks. It took several decades before they authorized it for officers. So even though it was the Army created it, the Navy thought it was a good idea, and then after Scott retired, or was pushed out, whichever way you want to look at it, then the Army adopted the Medal of Honor. It was our first, and at that time our only medal, so it was open for abuse, and unfortunately, I can't get into a lot of the aspects of that. There's a very fascinating one involving this Maine regiment, the 27th Maine, that's a digression of the Battle of Gettysburg, but what they did in helping garrison Washington during this crisis set them up for the whole unit to receive the Medal of Honor for what amounted to volunteering to extend their enlistments until the crisis had passed.
That kind of tarnishes the whole idea behind the Medal of Honor, don't you think?
Yes, and that led to what amounted to the Purge of 1917, which is another story.
Which, yes, we will get to that. I'm looking through my notes here. It said during the Battle of Gettysburg, 58 Medals of Honor were earned during that time period.
Yes, and in point of fact, everyone from the 20th Maine, 27th Maine, received it, which means 864 guys received the Medal of Honor for standing guard.
Out of 3,400, right? Total right now. Luckily, they had, I guess you could say, luckily they had that purge. I just think it's fascinating, and I really want our audience to understand that even though we're kind of belaboring the topic of Gettysburg, it is such an important event in American history that without that, I don't know, we could all be speaking with a southern drawl right now. We could all be, you know, 50 individual states or individual countries. It'd be amazing to see what would happen. We got about a minute left. If you wanted to just jump in with an idea of what you think might have happened. Craig, I'll start with you.
Well, I think that Gettysburg, and I should mention, along with Vicksburg, which took place actually at identical same moment, 1,000 miles away, neither knew the other was going on at the time, but coincidentally, those two pivot points in the Civil War, they didn't decide the war. They changed the trajectory and the momentum of the war, and up until that moment, I think many Southerners and some Northerners thought the South was winning and probably would win this thing. Afterward, I think that mindset changed. So these battles didn't necessarily change history, but they changed the temperament and the mindset and the trajectory of the war. And I think it was important to our national history. And Lincoln, of course, when he visited the battlefield in November, captured better than anyone else has or will the meaning of that engagement and that war.
Well, I think it's going to be fascinating when we continue this story in a couple of weeks. So make sure all of our listeners out there pay attention. We'll announce when we're going to do part two of the Battle of Gettysburg. I want to thank Craig Simons, Wing Van Sant, and Dwight Zimmerman for being on Veterans Radio today. Folks, listen in.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, guys. It's great to talk to you again, and we'll be in touch very soon. Until next week, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.